Hello, my name is Andrew Zai, and I am the social media chairman for the IEEE International Symposium on Phased Array Systems and Technology being held in Boston, Massachusetts in 2019. If you've already been listening to the podcast, you've heard in a previous episode, I've spoken to Dr. Jeff Hurd of MIT Lincoln Laboratory, who is also the conference chairman, about his efforts to cost reduce phased arrays in his MPAR program. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Bill Whedon, the president and CEO of Applied Radar, and also the vice chairman of our conference. In the recording, we speak about some of his experiences as a businessman and the history and future of phased array technology. Before we get started, I just wanted to announce something. We're still soliciting papers for the event, so please make sure you submit your papers before March 15th, 2019. You can do this at array2019.org. If you have any other announcements or concerns or questions, feel free to reach out to me at andrewzai.com. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the recording. Hello, I'm here today with Bill Whedon. He is the president and CEO of Applied Radar, and he is also the vice chair of the 2019 International Symposium on Phased Array Systems and Technology. So Bill, welcome. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hello, Andrew, and the phased array community. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the IEEE phased array audience. Right. So, as you mentioned, I'm the vice chair of the IEEE Phased Array Conference, which is coming up this October. We're getting really excited about that, and I'm working with the Jeff Hurd, who's the chairman, and the rest of the planning committee, including Andrew, to ensure another great conference. But my background, so I've been in business. I've had my own small business for just over 20 years now. And I started out, a lot of people ask me, well, how do I get started? You know, customers ask me that all the time, that kind of thing. So I got my my doctorate in electromagnetics from Northeastern University in Boston. And I got a bachelor's and master's there. And then I got a doctorate in from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Back in 94. And then I did a postdoc for a couple of years after that, back at Northeastern. I wanted to get back home to the Boston area. And I worked on ground penetrating radar. And then I started a business right after that, doing radar analysis, which is what I was doing at that time, processing radar data. And a friend of mine, who also had a business, suggested that I kind of, in order to make money in this business, you have to have a product. And so we kind of started getting more into more product focused. This is around, the late 90s. I was doing some consulting work with MACOM back then and on automotive radars, and also doing some work supporting the Air Force Research Lab, which was then based at Hanscom Air Force Base. Specifically the antenna research group there. And then I started doing SBIR, small business innovation research contracts, and kind of grew from there. And, we've seen that program grow, from when I started doing it 20 years ago, it kind of grew and then it blossomed. And then the SBIRs have been harder and harder to get these days. And so I started diversifying my business more into commercial products, where we now have, some catalog products, including frequency converters and synthesizers, and we're getting ready to launch a radar product now that we're excited about, which is a digital receiver exciter. It's a full radar, but it's based upon a digital receiver exciter core. So that's what I've been dabbling with, over the last 20 years. It's been really exciting having my own business. It was never really about making money per se. It was really more about the reason I started my business was more about so that I could have the freedom to explore, different technologies and be able to set my own technical direction. But it's been an interesting ride. And you know,
that
we had
sounds like it's been a lot of fun. Just kind of circling back to your early education, did you go straight through from Northeastern to go to the PhD?
I did, right. And the reason I did that was I did really well in my undergraduate. You know, I was a top student, but you know, I had opportunities back then with you know, fellowships and scholarships and things like that. And, you know, in electrical engineering, a lot of times most people don't pay for their graduate school in electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're young and you don't have family commitments and you don't have a full-time job, it's really easy to kind of cruise through, you know, I mean, it's still hard work and everything, but it's in terms of the amount of time that it takes, it's relatively easy to kind of bang that out, you know, in a period of, you know, the doctorate in, you know, 4 years or so. I guess I was in school for a total of 10 years, but you know, it was a long time, of course, but when you have, you know, little kids running around and you have a mortgage and stuff like that, it's a lot more difficult. So I chose to do that. Yeah.
And so then you went to a postdoc afterwards, and then so while your postdoc was coming to an end, did you just decide what was really the driving factor that made you want to start your own business?
I'm not really sure what it was. I've always wanted. I knew that, you know, even when I was in grad school, that I wanted to, you know, have my own business. I just, maybe it was because I did a couple of co-ops when I was at Northeastern. I did a co-op at Raytheon, and I also did some work at MITRE. And I just, you know, I saw what it was like in the you know, in the big company world, and I just thought it'd be exciting to kind of you know, to dabble on my own. And be able to have more independence, and that's kind of why I chose that.
So, what was the first thing that you did with your company to generate revenue?
Yeah, it was kind of hard. It was, you know, consulting is really what I did. You know, so you know, the idea is if you're starting a company right out of grad school, which I don't recommend. you know, in hindsight, I think I would have tried to get more experience first. You know, maybe either in academia. Not in academia, in industry or in government, and the reason is for a couple of reasons. One is you learn a lot of stuff that you don't learn in school, a lot of practical things working in a company, and the second thing is building a network of people that you can kind of draw upon, you know, for funding. But you know, to answer the question, you know, I started out and I reached out to some of the people that I had known in my graduate school days, you know, I went. You know, to Hanscom Air Force Base, and I got some work there, some consulting work there, and I went, you know, to MACOM, and we had a project with MACOM, and so that's kind of what I did. You know, anything to pay the bills is really the answer. You know, when you're first starting out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree more with you with the getting experience. I actually also kind of had the same idea you did. I actually did apply for SBIR when I was in graduate school, and they said it was technically sound, but I was very lacking in the plan for commercialization. And but yeah, since I've left to, you know, get some industry experience, I've definitely learned some of those tricks of the trades you were talking about on how to prototype, and then also just, you know, getting a little more mature and learning, you know, the fundamentals of that really drive a business are, you know, the cash flow and these sorts of things. So I'm trying to then educate myself on that. But congratulations to you for, you know, successfully doing this for 20 years plus now.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And it's been a bumpy road. You know, there's been ups and downs, but it's been a learning experience. And I like to think that now we're a lot smarter than we were about how to run a business and, you know, and how to build products and things like that. You know, so, you know, when you go through and you get your PhD, you know, straight out in 10 years, you think you know everything, you know, right? You have a lot of book knowledge, right? But you don't have practical knowledge, right? Like, like one of the things that's critical that we've been really focusing a lot on is quality, right? And that word quality is something that you don't really think too much about when you're an academic and, you know, you're good with equations and computers and things like that. So what does that mean? So let's say I want to, delivering a product, and anybody can make one of anything, right? But let's say, you know, a year or 2 years or 5 years from now, another customer orders the same product that you built 5 years ago And you don't even have the same engineers, you know, working there anymore, the guy that developed it and the people that built it. So how are you going to develop that? You know, or, you know, you don't want to have to redevelop it. You want to be able mm-hmm. to build the thing from a print. And so the idea, that's where, you know, kind of the idea of like ISO comes in. Whereas you have drawings and the idea is that, you know, you're building something to a print, to a certain quality standard, and it's going to be inspected, and you're going to stand behind that product. And those are things that they don't really teach you in school, that are really important for a business, because people want to, you know, when they buy a product from you, they expect, you know, a certain level of, you know, quality there, you know, that it's going to have a warranty and that the thing's going to work properly and it's going to do what it says it does.
Yeah, it sounds like such a simple concept, but we're experiencing that very thing where I work right now. We you know, we built one prototype and it works, but building two of the same thing, when you start building these very complicated systems, you definitely need to document exactly how you do things, because while you're trying to get it working on the bench, you're changing things on the fly, and you need to definitely capture all that, because it's a very real possibility that you'll build something and forget what you built.
Right, exactly. You know, and the service business is different, right? So if you're providing a service, let's say you're a software programmer, you're just providing your services, you're showing up, you know, you're a consultant or something like that, and you're showing up and you're typing code or something like that, and you get paid for your man hours. But when you're building a product, it's different. You have to have that quality. And, you know, so a service is good. You can make good money, you know, especially with a PhD in electrical engineering. You can make a good hourly rate, but the problem is it's hard to walk away from that. It's hard to take a vacation, or what if you get sick or something like that, or, you know, you get disabled, that source of revenue is gone. But it's not really scalable unless you just hire a whole bunch of, you know, people that are, you know, are identical to you, or you have the same set of background, versus a product is something that, if you can design the product and have a good set of prints where you have, you know, a factory that can build it, or you can assign it for somebody else to build it, then, you know, you can kind of make money. It will scale itself as if there's enough demand for your product.
So. Great. So we better talk about some phased arrays here. So
yes.
why don't you kind of give us a historical background of what a phased array used to be comprised of, and then what are some of the more recent developments that are really revolutionizing the industry?
Sure. So I've taught this course, this tutorial at the IEEE Phased Array Symposium. I guess I've been teaching this thing for about 10 years or so now. We have the conference every few years, and I think this is the third or fourth time I've offered it. And I typically teach it with one or two other people. You know, this year, Doug Carlson from MACOM will be joining me, and also Gabriel Rebus from UCSD. We'll be teaching the tutorial on TR modules. In that tutorial, I like to kind of go back to what they used to look like. And if you go and look at some of these legacy radar systems, you can see a lot of wire wrap and stuff like that. I mean, radars are particularly military radars that I'm talking about here, phased array military radars. They're expected to have a lifetime of 50 years or so, maybe more, maybe 60 years or so. And so technology that we used back in the 1970s and 80s, that stuff is still around. And in fact, we have a relationship with one of the Air Force bases where we are getting requests to refurbish some of these old radars. So we're seeing, you know, some of the stuff, the way things were designed back then. But in terms of the core technology for a phased array, you need some type of phase shifting element, right? So the idea with a phased array, as we all know, is that you have, you know, a bunch of antenna elements, and you want to be able to induce some type of phase delay. And when you talk about a phase delay, you're assuming a very narrow band, a single frequency or a narrow band. Nowadays, phased arrays are expected to do a lot more and cover many more bands. And so the concept of a phase shifter is almost obsolete. But, you know, kind of in the simplest, form, phase shifters were used, 30 or 40 years ago, maybe 20 years ago even, would be like a ferrite phase shifter, or they could be like a varactor diode or something along those lines, some type of an element that could induce a phase shift that's controlled by some type of electrical signal, a control signal.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, well, it kind of gets back to what's the transmit power source. So back, 20, 30 years ago, we were using different types of tubes to generate the microwave power, klystrons, traveling wave tubes, and things like that. Those are coherent sources. In your microwave oven, you have a magnetron, which is non-coherent, mm-hmm. right? But these big power tubes that were coherent, they generated, megawatts of energy and, high peak power, low duty cycle. And the phase shifter elements had to be able to handle that power because there was one source of power that got distributed with some type of a power distribution network. And then you induced a phase through like a phase shifter, which can handle that type of power. PIN diodes can handle a lot of power. Nowadays, technology has changed. And back in the 1990s, we had MAFET and these programs that were funded by DARPA where the gallium arsenide phase shifters were developed. Gallium arsenide power amplifiers, LNAs, and phase shifters. And so we kind of moved towards that technology. Now we're experiencing kind of a similar revolution in technology in phased arrays where that gallium arsenide technology is being replaced by technologies such as SiGe, silicon germanium technology, CMOS technology, and I think those are probably the two big technologies. But basically, the GaAs was an analog RF technology, whereas when we start getting into the CMOS and the SiGe, now we're seeing more and more digital technology getting into the array. So we're kind of seeing the confluence of the digital and the RF kind of being merged together. And you can ask me the same question: why are we doing that? What's the advantage? And I think that there's several advantages. And you can say, of course you're going to say cost. Okay, but there can be plus and minuses to the cost, because if you look at the cost of a mask, of a silicon germanium mask, I mean, it's astronomical. You need a tremendous volume in order to justify the cost of some of these components. For applications such as 5G, yes, I mean, you can justify those costs because the amount of, base station antennas that are out there is going to be astronomical. But for radars, typically the volume is relatively small. And so you have to make some of these cost analyses in order to justify the technology. But certainly, the digital technology getting into the phased array is opening up a whole number of doors that we didn't have before, because you have better calibration, you have better control of the array, you have digital beamforming, you have adaptive nulling. There's a number of advantages to the digital beamforming that is enabled by the digital, getting the digital technology closer to the array.
So can you explain to us what digital beamforming is?
Sure. All right. So we talked about how we did it in the past with the ferrite phase shifters and then the gallium arsenide technology. And now, essentially what we're saying is, okay, instead of having a PA and an LNA and a phase shifter at every element, we're going to put essentially a frequency converter. We're going to on the receive side, we're going to down convert. Let's say the array is at X band. We're going to down convert that frequency. Every element in the array, we're going to down convert that to a convenient intermediate frequency such as L band. And we're going to sample that directly with an analog to digital converter. Now, if your radar phased array is already at L band, you don't have to do that down conversion. And same thing on the transmit side, the up conversion. But the idea is that we are going to downsample that RF signal at every element, and we're going to digitize it. And now we have, bits coming from every element in the array, and we can digitally steer the beam. And how do we do that? Well, you can imagine if you have a high enough sample rate, you can do a whole sample delay of the samples, or you actually need to do subsample delay to be able to steer the beam digitally using, for example, you can use a filter, an FIR filter to do that. You can use an FFT. There's a number of ways you can do the digital beamforming. But the idea is that now you have digital bits from every element, and you can, you know, however, you know, you choose to do that signal processing, you can you can steer the beam to look in different directions. Sometimes, you know, on receive anyway, you can look in different directions at the same time.
So really, with an analog array, you have to set your phase shifters to look at one particular direction with your pencil beam. Whereas with digitally recording, the whole scene is there, and it's just a matter of how much math you want to do on your digital signal as to how many directions you want to look. Is that sort of the
Yeah, it's not necessarily recording. It's, you know, on a benchtop you can record the data, but we like to have these real time. For a radar system, you have to have actionable intelligence that you're getting from the radar, whether it be intrusion detection or looking for, you know, airborne surveillance or what have you. So you want to be able to do that real time. And so it's not necessarily MATLAB after the fact, you know, loading data from disk. It's really how can you process all that data in real time and keep up with the radar timeline, the scan rate, the PRIs, and so on and so forth. And that becomes a real challenging processing task, which involves we typically use FPGAs, field programmable gate arrays, to do a lot of that processing in real time. Hmm. And so the radars are really becoming software defined right now. You know, you've probably heard the term software defined radio. Well, a similar thing's happening with radars now, where the radars, where the processing is becoming software defined. Previously a lot of the work, hard work, went into building the arrays, the wire bonding and chip and wires and things like that. And nowadays you build the hardware, and the hardware becomes a lot more standard from system to system, but the software that runs it becomes a lot more complex and involved, and it takes sometimes years to develop that firmware to make the system have its unique and special characteristics that it needs to perform its mission.
So it sounds like there's a lot more digital expertise that's needed in the radar community now than was typically the case. Usually it was, you know, almost exclusively an RF field, but it sounds like it's becoming more and more multidisciplinary.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. And it helps, you know, it helps if the digital engineers have some knowledge of the RF and vice versa. When you're trying to process some data, it helps to have an idea of, you know, of the you know, the RF and so on and so forth. So RF, microwave and RF engineers aren't completely being ruled out of the marketplace, but there is definitely a need for more and more computer scientists, let's say, to help us with optimize the performance of the radars. But on the other hand, the radars can do a lot more that they couldn't do before. So I mentioned the bandwidth. Radars these days are expected to be a lot more wideband, so that they can handle, they can do multiple functions. They can handle multiple threats, the ECM threats, for example, also dealing with the spectrum allocation, being able to operate, you know, in some type of a contested environment where you have, you know, intentional and unintentional jammers and things like that. So one example would be the MPAR radar that's being developed, you know, to survey, you know, our national airspace system and also, you know, for the weather. Mm-hmm. And also monitoring, FAA. So the capability that those new radars are going to offer compared to the previous Doppler, NOAA Doppler weather radars is much higher. They're going to, those radars will provide much more real-time severe storm analysis and alerting than we previously had. There's a number of advantages, and I'll let, you know, probably somebody else like our chair Jeff Hurd talk more about that.
Some good detail on how they're bringing costs down. It's pretty impressive work,
right? But there's other applications for, not just that, but, you know, in military radars, but also automotive. You know, if you look at some of the some of the requirements that some of these automotive radars are required to do. Airborne radars for, you know, airborne sensing and things like that. They're just expected to do a lot because we're capable of doing more, because we have the digital data. There's a lot more that can be done, and it's an exciting time to be working in these areas.
So phased arrays are obviously have a very strong radar background, and there's always going to be an application for them there. But do you see a future for them in telecom? I know there's been a lot of talk about 5G, and I'm sure they would love to have the performance. But do you think we're going to hit the cost point where it's actually commercially viable to have 5G arrays?
Well, yeah. In fact, I just got a letter from the new CEO of Verizon that they're investing more heavily in the 5G technology and talking about some of the benefits, you know, that it's going to offer, you know, hundreds of, you know, of times the bandwidth and so on and so forth. But as you mentioned, the cost is the key there. And 5G, when you're talking about a 5G phased array, we're talking like 28 gigahertz, 39 gigahertz, you know, frequencies that are really in the millimeter wave realm of the spectrum. And we're talking about deploying, you know, millions of these phased array systems for the comms application in order to, you know, jack up the bandwidth they need to steer the beam, direct the beam more, and direct towards specific users and that type of thing. But the cost is really the key there. And the technology that's being developed in the CMOS area is really what's going to revolutionize that and enable those 5G arrays to flourish. And so it's still a very active area of R&D. CMOS technology.
You think it has to be up at the millimeter wave because that's the only place where it can do all the stuff on a chip?
No, I think the millimeter wave has more to do with the size of the array versus the size of the beam and things like that. It really comes down to the physics of the antenna. You know, it's actually easier, you know, it's easier to build a chip that works at 1 gigahertz than it is to build one that works at 40 gigahertz. Hmm. You know, at the higher frequencies, the array spacing is much smaller, so you have to fit in the necessary front end chips into a much smaller area. So that becomes much more challenging. So typically things get much more difficult when you go to higher frequencies in the phased array business. And so the way that they are kind of getting around that is, and we started seeing this with SiGe Technologies, incorporating the beamforming for multiple adjacent elements on a single chip. So you'd have one chip that serves like either 4 or 8 elements, for example. And so you're able to pack more stuff using either SiGe or CMOS technology. You're able to pack more functions on a single chip. Whereas back in the 1990s, you know, one chip was one element. In fact, it was actually more like 3 or more chips for one element. Hmm. So even at X-band back then, we had a hard time fitting everything onto, you know, into the footprint of, you know, half wavelength, like a postage stamp kind of thing. and now you can imagine that, you know, at 40 gigahertz or so, you're talking about the, you know, something that's the size of the, you know, the eraser on your pencil or even smaller. So trying to pack, you know, all the, you know, the gain and the phase that you need there, and the switches and limiters and things, trying to pack all that into one element becomes difficult. They're doing quite a good job with the new chip technology of being able to pack a lot more stuff in there, and that's really helping to enable those applications.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where the industry goes in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I mean, you know, so I'm 52 years old. So, you know, I grew up and I went through college when the IBM PC was just kind of becoming, going through its heyday, so to speak. We started, I remember, you know, in some of my early undergrad classes, we started with the IBM XT, which is, you know, an 8088 processor, that kind of thing. And just saw the revolution, you know, in the PC business, we went from, you know, we had PCs and then we went to Sun workstations and that kind of thing. And, you know, we never thought that, when I was a grad student, back in the 90s, we never thought that a PC would be able to, displace a Sun workstation. And the same, you know, same argument went, for these, you know, these big, computers that they had, the PDP-11s and so on and so forth, the VAXs and everything else. But it's really the chip technology that just, it just skyrocketed with Moore's law and so on and so forth. They were able to pack more and more stuff onto a chip. And I think we're going to see a similar thing with phased array technology enabled by the 5G technology, where they're, you know, these, CMOS, chips that they're building now are being, built on a 12-inch wafer. And, you know, the 12-inch wafer, allows a much lower cost and higher reliability than they were able to have with smaller wafers. And they're able to operate these CMOS at into the millimeter wave part of the spectrum and do these RF functions that we never thought possible even a few years ago. And so it's going to be interesting to see that. Because I really think that we're on the verge of a revolution in the phased array business.
So you're a business owner and you're constantly trying to hire people with the right skill sets. So what would your advice be to some of the students listening to this as to what areas they should get educated on if they want to, you know, ride on this technology wave of, you know, arrays and 5G and all these coming technologies?
Well, I think the device technology, I mean, there's a lot of exciting things happening in that area. There's different, you know, there's different sides that, you know, sides of the business you could kind of play on. You know, certainly there's a huge demand for people, for engineers that have FPGA skills right now. Antenna engineers certainly are needed. How many antenna engineers are going to be needed? Probably not as many as are needed for the, you know, in the, you know, signal processors and, you know, FPGA, real-time FPGA designers. That's where a lot of the need is right now. Chip technology, people that can design chips. That's a very niche business. If you can design to chips that operate, at these, you know, these huge frequencies. But in order to design these chips, you have to have RF skills. You have to have, you have to know your way around the Smith chart. You have to know how to use the design tools, the circuit simulations, whether it be HFSS or CST or microwave office or whatever. You have to not only know how to use the tools and push a button, but you have to be able to understand what the results mean. And if something doesn't quite work, you know, how do you handle, you know, or try and identify root cause of, you know, why something's not quite working, whether it be reflections or what have you. Yeah, I think in the phased array business, there's definitely a need for, you know, a diverse set of skills, but they have to be well grounded. You have to have a good fundamental understanding of RF and electromagnetics.
Yeah, I agree that the FPGA guys, they're very hard to come by. So if you're trying to figure out what to do with your school and you're at all interested in that, that's definitely a good place to turn your attention to. But understanding the fundamentals of the array are still what it boils down to at the end of the day.
Well, you know, I mean, certainly, just knowing Maxwell's equations is not enough, right? I mean, you and I took our first RF class and we were able to, you know, kind of understand. Nobody fully understands Maxwell equations because they predict everything that's going on from DC to light. But if you're a theorist, you're not going to make it very far in the phased array world. You really need to get into some of the, have a good handle on some of the practical tool sets, know how to use the tool sets, whether they be tools for designing chips or tools for, designing, you know, FPGA code or, you know, tools for simulating things. You have to have a good practical, good practical design skills to be useful in this phased array business.
Great. So what's next for Applied Radar? What do you hope to take the company in the next 5 years, and what kind of problems are you working on right now?
Well, we're getting ready for a product launch right now. So we have a parallel company that we launched a few years ago called Quonset Microwave, where we just push out commercial products. As I mentioned, we have some, you know, catalog stuff, synthesizers and components and things like that. We're getting ready to launch a new radar product. We really want to do it right. We have a receiver exciter working on our benchtop, that we're getting ready to put together a data sheet, and put it out for, probably about a half a dozen or so trial, places to evaluate the new product. You know, when you're launching a new product, you want to do it right, because if you put something out there that's not ready, that doesn't work, you're going to get a bad reputation. It's going to fall flat. But if you have something that you can put out there and you have a data sheet and the product does what it says that it does, then people will get excited about it, and they'll want more. There'll be more demand for it. So we're kind of getting ready for that. This product will probably be launched under the Applied Radar flagship name. Because it's really a industrial grade radar that people can use. It's kind of like a car engine, if you would imagine. So we're a small company. We're not going to be in the business of putting radars out there in the field, for particularly in the military radar. But if we can design a kind of a core component that goes into the radars, and we're kind of looking at this new product similar to like a USERP for software defined radios. So it will be a component. It's a fully functioning radar, but people will use it to develop their own product. So that's kind of what we're looking towards right now in the next quarter, and also continuing our government business, government R&D. So that's kind of where things are right now. As I mentioned, when I first started the company, it was it really wasn't about making money. It wasn't quite a sandbox, but it was a way of making a living. While I, you know, had the flexibility to, you know, and freedom to work in different areas and learn about different technologies, but as you get older, your vision kind of shifts a little bit, you get kids that are getting ready to go to college, and you got to start making a little bit more money, you know.
Yeah, mine's still pretty young, but I can already feel the pressure.
Yeah. So it's,
well, I definitely wish you luck with your product. I know I've personally used your PLL module, and I've been very impressed with it. We even torture tested it to do things that it wasn't supposed to do in the data sheet, and it still performed very well. So I think you have another successful product in the pipeline if you do it like the first one.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
And, you know, marketing a product, that's a whole nother area, you know, it's a whole other set of skills that they don't teach in electromagnetics. So,
yeah, or engineering school in general.
Right. Exactly. You got to go to Harvard Business School, I guess, for that.
Yeah. Is there anything that, anything else you wanted to talk about, or any final parting words you wanted to share with the audience?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I'm looking forward to a successful, conference, and, it's just amazing how much the technology has changed since 2016 was the last time we did this conference, and hopefully, you know, we hope to continue this, you know, the tradition of doing this conference every few years. But I would definitely encourage people to attend, both you know, professionals and academians and students alike, to come and join the in supporting the IEEE Phased Array Conference. It should be really interesting to see where, you know, the technology has evolved over the last few years.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Bill. I definitely learned a good amount during the call, and I hope you enjoyed recording with me.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate you taking on this task and responsibility.
Great. And, well, I'll see you at the next meeting.
Talk to you later.
Yep.
All right. Over and out.
Bye-bye.